I am Dracula. I bid you welcome.
Hello, I'm Annie Corrigan. This is Unearthing Dracula. That was Bela Lugosi in perhaps the most iconic performance of Dracula ever, from 1931.
The arm across the face immediately means Bela Lugosi with his cape showing just his glowing eyes. Just to be able to say Ivanth is enough to make people know that Suck Your Blood is going to come immediately after that.
And that's Jeff Holdeman, our resident Dracula expert. Throughout the next hour, we'll explore the evolution from the character in Bram Stoker's 1897 novel to the many movies featuring the Count and the very real historical figure who is now inextricably linked to the father of all vampires, Vlad Tepes. Stay with us. Jeff Holdeman, you teach a class about Dracula at Indiana University, so you're serving as our expert today. Before we get to the horrific Dracula, I'm staring at the Dracula Lego man you brought, so let's talk about Dracula for kids. We've got Count Chocula cereal, and then we've got the Count on Sesame Street. So this character isn't just relegated to horror movies. We use him to sell breakfast cereal to children and to teach kids how to count. How can we reconcile these two halves of the Dracula character?
What a lot of people don't know is the folkloric vampire in some regions is an obsessive counter. And one way to distract, to keep the vampire at bay, is to cast a handful of poppy seeds, which are also a soporific, but they're also very, very small. And in some regions, the vampire might have to count one seed per year. Or that the vampire, upon seeing all these sprinkled seeds, would have to pick up each and every one. And they are very small. And so you have this obsessive compulsive drive within the vampire to want to count. How Sesame Street producers picked up on that little itty-bitty fact is just sheer genius.
You think that that was a conscious choice on their parts?
Sesame Street creators are geniuses. I do not put that past them, that they picked up on that little bitty fact.
Greetings.
Hi there. Hey, you got a very squeaky daughter, fella.
I am the Count. Huh. Do you know why they call me the Count? Mm-hmm. Because I love to count. One, two, three.
Count Chocula is an interesting question. So first off, you know, the vampire who doesn't eat or who eats blood, you'd think that he would get a red cereal. But that was – red was already taken by Frankenberry, who has strawberries. We have Booberry, who gets the blueberry, the ghost. Fruit Brute, which a lot of people don't remember, is the werewolf who eats his fruity cereal. And then there was Yummy Mummy, which was, again, another fruity cereal. Didn't really take off that well. And we're left with chocolate. So and then you get the chalk along with the drac. And Chocula and Count Chocula. It just has a nice ring to it.
Chocolatey cereal with chocolatey marshmallow bats. Satisfies a chocolate monster in no time flat. The monstrously good part of a complete breakfast.
Chocolatey cereals, and you've got these chocolate M&Ms, red Dracula M&Ms with fangs.
But the sheer genius of having the red M&M as portraying the vampire is just really appropriate. And again, clever. That's something that's well done. But we have greeting cards and birthday cards.
All of the
Twilight materials and pomegranate soda.
Vampire soda?
It's hard to tell whether the creators are actually clever enough to realize that, number one, it's a red soda, so it's blood-like. The can, of course, has the widow's peak and the teeth, the blood-twinged teeth, but also that the pomegranate is the symbol of Persephone, who spends half of the year in the underworld, from Greek legend. Whether that's just the pomegranate industry trying to get soda into us, or someone who's very, very clever and knows their Greek mythology as well as their Eastern European mythology.
Wow.
I could only desire to contact each and every one of these companies and ask the the design team, how they came up with each of these things.
Did you actually know what you were doing?
In old Transylvania, when I was a lad, our castle was cold, yet we never were sad. We learned to be happy, we danced round the hall, and learning to count was the key to it all. One, two, three, spread out the cape. One, two, three, twirl round the floor. One, two, three, left foot you swing. One, two, three, then start to sing. One, two, three, loud as you please. One, two, three, counting with ease. One, two, three, doing the fatty bat.
Welcome back to Unearthing Dracula. I'm Annie Corrigan. We're lucky enough to have an expert on Dracula right here at the Indiana University campus. He's Jeff Holdeman, faculty member in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at IU. He's also the director of the Global Village Living Learning Center, where in the fall he teaches a course on vampires. So, Jeff, how did you get interested in vampires?
It's a tough question. My family is actually from Transylvania. So my maternal grandmother was born in Transylvania. So I guess I always had that connection with Transylvania and Romania and the folklore and everything. My education is in Slavic languages, linguistics, cultures. And then as a graduate student at Ohio State, I helped teach a class on vampires.
There's enough material about vampires from folklore to literature and film to cultural representations of vampires that I guess you can fill an entire semester course.
I spend 15 weeks rushing very quickly through it in my course and still, you know, have more things to say, more things to do, more information to impart.
Which is why we're narrowing the field a bit and focusing on the man himself, Count Dracula. As we'll point out, Dracula, the character, especially in films, has evolved over time from the rat-like Nosferatu in 1922 to the regal Bela Lugosi Dracula of 1931 to Christopher Lee, who played Dracula in a bunch of films for Hammer Studios in the 50s and 60s. Then Frank Langella in 1979, whose Dracula didn't even have fangs or the characteristic wolf eyes, to the sort of creepy ladies' man, I guess, of Gary Oldman in the 1992 film. Jeff, something about this character keeps him coming back over and over throughout the years, each time looking a little bit different.
So one of the threads of the course is a quote by Nina Auerbach, which is, "Every age creates the vampire that it needs." And so every age, meaning this time and context and place and the people and the society, creates the vampire, this embodiment of evil or embodiment of the question of death and immortality and one's urges to survive, creates the vampire that it needs, that there's some function in this vampire, that we are using it as a metaphor to deal with things, to come to copes with things, to explore new ideas.
So then how has every age transformed Dracula to be the vampire that it needs?
So I think we can identify three different Draculas. I think the core is Bram Stoker's 1897 novel, his fictitious literary Dracula. He based that extremely loosely off of a 15th century, now Romania, Wallachian ruler who was known as Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler.
Okay, so that's number two.
The third Dracula is the Dracula which is spawned from the novel and everything, and then the movies itself, that has shown a lot of evolution into the character.
So we'll get to the cinematic incarnations of Dracula in a bit. When talking about the first two Draculas, the Bram Stoker character and the historical figure of Vlad Tepes, it sounds like we sort of have to combine these conversations. So we'll work backwards in time then, starting with Bram Stoker himself. The Irishman, who wrote theater criticisms when he moved to England, was associated with the famous actor Henry Irving, even became the manager of his company, actually. So how does a guy like that then go on to write one of the most important horror novels ever?
So Bram Stoker really threw himself into Dracula, researched it extensively most of the 1890s, collected information from different sources that he had access to in London. Among them were books on Transylvania folklore. One in particular was a book written by Emily Gerard, who traveled extensively in Transylvania, lived there with her husband, went out into the villages, and she includes vampire folklore in her writings. At some point, he also discovered the name of Dracula. Before that, Stoker was going to call him Count Vampire. And then as soon as he saw Dracula, I think linguistically, he knew he had a winner. And then to hear that there was this historical character who was associated with blood and cruelty and impaling and not a whole lot beyond that was enough to at least give him this connection to a historical figure that no one else had heard of. So it was relatively virgin territory to go into.
Okay, so then who was Vlad Sepeš, Vlad the Impaler?
Vlad was born in Sighișoara, in Transylvania. Was the son of a voivod, of a ruler in Wallachia. This was the time when the Ottoman Turks are invading, approaching and invading Europe. So we'll get the fall of Constantinople at this time. Vlad is a national hero in Romania for being a protector, a defender of Christianity, of Orthodoxy, against the Turks. So his very cruel methods, which were, if you can say, appropriate for the time or characteristic of the time. If you think of a person who is trying to defend his religion from another, you do that by any means possible at that time. And so in the 1400s, if you have a certain fondness for impaling people on very long pikes, and that's a nice visual way of telling people to stay away, and if not, this is what we're going to do to you, was effective.
Hmm. Explain the actual connection to the Bram Stoker character then.
Well, the Dracula name then is what gets borrowed. Dracula, his father was Dracul. He was in the order of the dragon. So Drac means both dragon and devil. And then his son is the son of this person who's the order of the dragon. So that name is well known. So the fact that gets taken and there is only one Dracula, that tie is close enough. And then when people started researching exactly where Bram Stoker got this, and as the Romanian connections were made stronger, and then in the 70s there were documentaries where Florescu and McNally went out and tried to research the historical roots of Dracula, then this really hit the Western awareness, historical awareness, that there was actually a historical character named Dracula. And what is not being said is, oh, and by the way, he's not actually a vampire.
We'll talk about what the Romanian people must think about all this in a second. If you'd like to see these images, check them out on our website, wfiu.org/Dracula. Let's now listen to some music that would have been heard around the time of Vlad Sepeš. This is Dragai Curcha, music performed by the group Cansonier.
Thank you.
2010 album of all music from around the time of Lotsepish, the 15th century. That was Dragaj Kurča, performed by the group Canzonier. So you were saying he's seen as a national hero in Romania. I would then imagine that the Romanian people aren't especially happy about what his name now brings to mind.
So some people have said what Bram Stoker did to the figure of Dracula would be like our turning George Washington into a vampire. And so maybe wooden teeth turn into wooden fangs. I don't know. But but this idea of taking someone who is a cruel but positive figure on being a defender of the national religion in a time when the rest of Christendom fell to the Ottoman Turks is hard for the Romanians to accept that they've had their national hero taken away from them and turned into a vampire. So turned into one of their own folklore. So it's sort of a double blow that you get your national hero taken away from you and turned into one of the creatures from your own folklore. I don't know if you'd like to see pictures of...
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. This looks like the famous portrait from the 16th century of him.
Which has this dark, thick mustache and a kind of royal headdress and maybe this representation of the Order of the Dragon on his forehead, but the dark eyes and the nose and the mouth. And then, unfortunately, my students no longer know who Gallagher is. But I pull up a picture of Gallagher, the watermelon smasher, with a crown but it's just it looks very much like him with this mustache.
Uncanny. And you've got another image here.
We have a woodcut of Vlad the Impaler at one of these famous picnics under the pikes, you might call it, of people eating. And there are legends like a person, one of the emissaries, complained that the smell of the rotting corpses was disturbing his meal. And so Vlad Tepes said, oh, well, we'll solve that, and gets an extra long pike and puts this person onto the pike above all the other bodies so that he won't be distracted by the smell.
Wow.
But again, this black and white woodcut very gruesomely depicted with the contrast of bodies impaled through the backs, although that's not what his preferred means was, and this person at a feast table.
Yeah, he looks like he's just eating a nice meal, and he's having conversation with the people on the sticks is what it sort of looks like.
And hacked up body parts,
yep, sure,
and everything else. Once you see that, and that adds to the romance, digging into the history of Vlad Tepes, the exotic and the mysterious and the completely gross and disturbing and everything else that just adds to that.
Yes, all of those things.
Appeal.
But really, how much of all these stories about him can we really believe?
He's so far back in history that there aren't enough records that really give us a true picture of who he was. A lot of the sources that we get are sometimes are called Hungarian propaganda, and people questioning about whether he really was that cruel or whether he really did kill 100,000 people and whether a lot of these stories are actually true. For the scant references and sources that we have, we'll never be able to prove that, which, again, adds to that romance.
It really does. It heightens the intrigue. Who really was this guy? Even if we don't have a whole slew of stories to prove it, perhaps that even adds to the intrigue even more. If you can somehow tie it to any sort of historical context, maybe it suddenly becomes so much more interesting.
And that's another thing that has really pushed the Dracula character, and that is our love of backstory. If you think of the origins of the actual novel, this is at the time when Freudian psychology is big and phrenology and criminal types are being studied. And again, this question of why do people do bad things? What is the source of evil? Why aren't we any better? Why haven't we solved all of the problems in the modern world? So this late Victorian novel that embodies a lot of the fears of the time ties in really nicely later on when we have a resurgence of an interest in psychology and this idea of backstory. What was it in this person's childhood that drove them to be this demon that they are now?
We'll delve more into the dark, dusty corners of Dracula's early life in just a few moments. You're listening to Unearthing Dracula. Stay with us. Welcome back to Unearthing Dracula. I'm Annie Corrigan, here with Jeff Holdeman, our resident Dracula expert here at Indiana University. This idea of Dracula's backstory and the connection to Vlad Tepes and how that adds to the mystique of Dracula, we really see that play out in the Bram Stoker novel and then in the 1992 Dracula film. It really tries to be pretty true to the book, so go ahead and describe the opening scene for us.
So we see this in the Francis Ford Coppola movie, where at the very outset of the movie, we have why the historical Dracula becomes a vampire.
Year 1462. Transylvania arose a Romanian knight of the Sacred Order of the Dragon, known as Dracula. On the eve of the battle, his bride, Elisabetta, whom he prized above all things on earth, knew that he must face an insurmountable force from which he might never return.
His wife commits suicide, thinking that her husband was dead. She's therefore not allowed to be given a Christian burial. He says, "I've been a defender of Christianity," and runs his sword into the cross, which then issues forth copious amounts of blood, and he curses, damns the church, and is therefore a heretic, which is grounds for becoming a vampire. And so now we have how Dracula becomes a vampire from his history, based on historical facts, because Vlad Tepes, his wife, commits suicide by throwing herself into the river. So this idea of backstory it brings us into like, well, what other dark, creepy, dusty corners are there in the life of Dracula that we can explore? And so then we get the daughters of Dracula and son of Dracula and Zoltan, Dracula's dog, and everything else, exploring these other darkened alleyways of Dracula's life. And it just gives more and more and more to go on.
Yeah, we can't get enough of it. It looks like, as of 2009, some 217 movies have featured the Dracula character in some major role, second only to Sherlock Holmes. So we'll come back to the 1992 film in a moment. But now, Jeff, let's go back to the novel by Bram Stoker. Surely you have students read this in your class.
We read the novel over 2 weeks, and it could very easily be an entire 15-week course to discuss all the themes and the techniques that Bram Stoker uses to create this late Victorian novel.
You have a section marked in the book. Could you go ahead and read a little bit?
I know what this section is in the novel, and this is when Mina Harker is being threatened by Dracula. And this is the scene in which Dracula is in her bedroom. Jonathan Harker, her husband, is in a stupor, passed out on the bed. The person who struck Dracula on the head in an attempt to kill him and leaves a scar on his forehead. This is one of the perhaps motivations for Dracula taking revenge on Jonathan via his wife, Mina. The moonlight was so bright that through the thick yellow blind, the room was light enough to see. On the bed beside the window lay Jonathan Harker, his face flushed and breathing heavily as though in a stupor. Kneeling on the near edge of the bed, facing outwards, was the white-clad figure of his wife. By her side stood a tall, thin man clad in black. His face was turned from us, but the instant we saw, we all recognized the Count, in every way, even to the scar on his forehead. With his left hand, he held both Mrs. Harker's hands, keeping them away with her arms at full tension. His right hand gripped her by the back of the neck, forcing her down on his bosom. Her white nightdress was smeared with blood, and a thin stream trickled down the man's bare breast, which was shown by his torn open dress. The attitude of the two had a terrible resemblance to a child forcing a kitten's nose into a saucer of milk to compel it to drink. As we burst into the room, the Count turned his face, and the hellish look that I had heard described seemed to leap into it. His eyes flamed red with devilish passion. The great nostrils of the white aquiline nose opened wide and quivered at the edge, and the white sharp teeth behind the full lips of the blood-dripping mouth champed together like those of a wild beast. With a wrench which threw his victim back upon the bed as though hurled from a height, he turned and sprang at us. But by this time, the professor had gained his feet and was holding towards him the envelope which contained the sacred wafer. And this ties into all the themes of revenge, blood revenge, the scar that Dracula carries on his forehead from the shovel that Jonathan tries to hit him with, tries to stake him with, which will then be mirrored by the burn from the communion wafer on Mina's head, which she will carry as the mark of her impurity until Dracula is killed at the end of the novel, is this beautiful parallel. The Francis Ford Coppola turns this into a love story, as if Mina is the incarnation of his wife. And actually at the end of the movie then, it's not the men who kill Dracula. They wound him and she goes into the castle, and then she actually is the one who kills him and beheads him at the very end. A wonderful 1992 women's empowerment as she takes charge of the situation and ends the curse.
There are other Dracula films that create a love story as well. So let's take a listen to music written to express this. From the Coppola film, this is the Mina and Dracula love theme, written by Wojciech Kilar. Gary Oldman played Dracula and Winona Ryder played the role of Mina in the 1992 Francis Ford Coppola film Bram Stoker's Dracula. Music of Wojciech Kilar. While we're talking about music, we of course have to mention John Williams' score to the 1979 Dracula film. John Badham directed, Frank Langella as the Count, a very different sort of Count at that. Definitely no slicked back black Bela Lugosi hairdo for Langella.
He had luscious, beautiful, feather cut, almost bouffant hair in 1979. We have that attractiveness, the appeal, the regalness of the nobility.
Which I guess is sort of similar to the Bela Lugosi rendition after all then. Just like the 1992 film, this movie also adds a romantic element between Dracula and, in this case, Lucy. Dracula, the ladies' man, what can we say? Let's go ahead and listen to some of the music, then, written by John Williams. Composer John Williams wrote that music for the 1979 film Dracula. We have plenty of other Draculas to talk about coming up, so stay with us. In the meantime, check out photos and videos on our website, wfiu.org/Dracula. I'm Annie Corrigan, and you're listening to Unearthing Dracula. Welcome back to Unearthing Dracula. I'm Annie Corrigan, and I'm joined by Jeff Holdeman, senior lecturer in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at Indiana University, and he teaches a class about vampires in the fall semester.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
Jeff, it seems like we go through phases with our trends here in this country. And with the recent popularity of the Twilight books and the movies and the television series True Blood, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it looks like we're experiencing, I guess, a resurgence in an interest in vampires. So let's look back on the vampire movies, but specifically Dracula movies, throughout the years. And talk to me about the connections you can draw.
So there's within the United States, there's this we go in waves definitely with our trends. What's interesting about vampires is that they stay popular pretty much at a relatively high level. The mummy has its rises and crashes and then stays dead, dormant for a really long time. Frankenstein's monster and those kind of themes, that also is a really good moment of humans playing God and the role of technology. The werewolf is wonderful because it's this embodiment of the animalistic side of humans. The vampire ties into life and death and blood and immortality and the sense of time The sense of fear, our fear of the dark and the night, the embodiment of evil, of what lie at our deepest levels among our fears.
Has there ever been a time when Dracula movies haven't been popular?
The one big drop in the vampire film industry was after World War II, when we get the atomic bomb. And then all of a sudden, the movies, the horror movies and things are all about science fiction and destruction and technology. And vampires don't exist very well in that kind of environment. And then in the 50s, when we get the Hammer Studios with Christopher Lee and Technicolor Blood, the vampires come back very, very strong.
This is the story of Dracula. A creature who destroys all whom he touches. Dracula, the terrifying, the feared, who sleeps in the tombs of the dead by day and arises at night to inflict his terror upon the innocent and the unsuspecting.
Oh, you must help me. You must. You're my only hope. You must.
I'll help you. I promise.
Christopher Lee. He played Dracula in that 1959 film, Horror of Dracula, as you said, by Hammer Studios. That was his first of what looks like 10 movies where he played the role of Dracula, all the way through to the mid-70s. How many Christopher Lee movies make it to the viewing list for your class?
I show Nosferatu in its entirety in my class, along with the beginnings and endings of four other famous movies: Bela Lugosi's 1931 Dracula, Christopher Lee 1959, Frank Langella 1979, and Gary Oldman 1992. All these movies are supposed to be based directly, so to speak, on the novel. There's nothing that's supposed to be in between the novel and the making of these movies as well.
We'll talk about Nosferatu in a moment. That's the earliest surviving film featuring the character of Dracula. But first, the iconic 1931 film, directed by Todd Browning.
I am Dracula.
For the most of the 20th century, when you said Dracula, people immediately imagined, pictured in their minds, Bela Lugosi from the 1931 movie, which was actually a screen adaptation of a play, and Bela Lugosi was the star, and the original filmmakers didn't even want him in that role, and he campaigned very, very actively to get the role and received a really ridiculously small amount of money to actually play that role, something like $500 a week.
This is very old wine. I hope you will like it.
Aren't you drinking?
I never drink. Why?
The 1931 movie is a talkie. It's black and white. It's this kind of parlor drama. So actually when most of my students have never seen that, and when they watch it, they think that it's really boring with very little action, a lot of talking and sort of somewhat over-the-top acting. But his dress as the count in the tuxedo as this, you know, noble character, I think was a really striking image. Again, thinking that this was 1931 and being right after the Great Depression, thinking about issues of class and wealth, thinking about this being the trail end of this huge Eastern European, Southern European immigration that came to the United States. Many people coming into the big cities and bringing their rural folklores and beliefs, superstitions with them as well, I think just sort of added to that impact and appeal. And so one of the statistics is that after 48 hours, they had sold 50,000 tickets for the opening of the movie, and they had had a lot of press about people passing out from fear in the movies as it was first being shown at the Roxy Theater.
Dracula? Oh, what's he done to you, dearie? Tell me.
He came to me, and he made me drink.
I think that sort of shows that what was going on in the United States. There was a lot of question about whether a horror movie like that would even be successful in the United States at that time. And then, of course, it proved itself that it was a right movie at a right time for the people.
It's surely stood the test of time as well. Well, at least Bela Lugosi's portrayal of Dracula has. Because, you know, his is the character we think about when we think of Dracula.
The arm across the face immediately means Bela Lugosi with his cape showing just his glowing eyes as well. Just to be able to say Ivanth is enough to make people know that Suck Your Blood is going to come immediately after that.
And as you said, this is a talkie, so no music was composed specifically for the film at the time. In the opening credits of the original film, we hear an excerpt from Act Two of Swan Lake by Tchaikovsky, a beautiful oboe solo. But in 1998, Philip Glass wrote a score for the film, performed by the Kronos Quartet. Music by Philip Glass, written for the 1931 Dracula film directed by Todd Browning. That was performed by the Kronos Quartet. That selection was titled Excellent, Mr. Renfield. There was a Dracula movie that came before that one in 1922, a German film, Nosferatu. That's the earliest surviving film featuring Dracula, and it was an unauthorized adaptation of the novel. Hence, the character of Count Dracula was actually named Count Orlok instead. And that role was played by Max Schreck.
I have pictures of Max Schreck. And so if you think of Bela Lugosi as being just 9 years after this, but this having this very rat-like Nosferatu with these pointed ears and rat-like front teeth and claws is really amazing. It's this dark, black-and-white, silent movie that is so much more shocking and scary and much more likely to give you bad dreams than the Bela Lugosi film. And yet this film often doesn't make it to American theaters except maybe around Halloween, so it's a really incredible movie.
Yeah, he looks much more monstrous in this than the Bela Lugosi for sure.
He really went all out with prosthetics, and they're actually it was such an amazing transformation, such an amazing performance that there are actually movies based on this, on their remakes of Nosferatu, of remakes of the filming of the movie, in which the filmmakers actually hire a real vampire to play the Nosferatu character in order to add realism.
Jeffrey Holdeman, senior lecturer in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at Indiana University. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about Dracula with me all day today. It's been a lot of fun. One more question before we get you out of here. Max Schreck, Bela Lugosi, Christopher Lee, Frank Langella, Gary Oldman, and there are plenty of other actors who've played the character of Dracula. But for me, and for a lot of people I know, Dracula is still Bela Lugosi, the whole package that he brought to that character. I wonder if you think his performance will ever be eclipsed in terms of staying power and recognizability.
The Bela Lugosi Dracula is so iconic that it rules most of the 20th century in terms of when you say vampire, not even Dracula, when you say vampire, our parents and grandparents were picturing Bela Lugosi. And only now is that changing with another rush of movies in the 80s and especially 90s, and now in the 21st century, we're actually seeing a little bit of the weakening of the connection between vampire and Bela Lugosi. And now it's weakening to Dracula as Bela Lugosi. But our image of Dracula from the Lego character that I brought in to the characterizations, if you want to make people have that association, it's the Bela Lugosi tuxedo, cape, widow's peak, black slicked back hair, creepy mannerisms, foreign accent, that really is the driver of our image of Dracula. And I think that will continue on for a very long time because we've already worked that into our American ideal of what the noble vampire looks like as well.
And now I'll leave you. Good night.
This has been Unearthing Dracula, a production of WFIU Indiana Public Media. Special thanks to Jeffrey Holdeman, senior lecturer in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at Indiana University in Bloomington. Our staff includes syndication manager Luann Johnson, marketing director John Bailey, executive producer Carrie Boyce, and executive in charge Perry Metz. Check out images and videos on our website, wfiu.org/Dracula. I'm your host and producer, Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.